Welcome to another episode of Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll. I'm your host, Michael Blaschke, bringing you insights from the cutting edge of digital assets, blockchain and monetary theory. Today, we're diving into one of the more consequential developments in the digital assets landscape, the contrast between US and EU approaches to regulating cryptocurrencies, stablecoins and blockchain. We're living through a fascinating inflection point in the history of money where these two powerhouses are charting different regulatory paths that will shape global finance for decades to come, potentially. We're fortunate to be joined by someone who stands out, someone at the intersection of TradFi, central banking and blockchain. Our guest today is John Helgi Egilsson, the executive director and co-founder of Monerium. John, we already had you as a guest in our episode, in a first episode about Monerium, so your fintech offering e-money on blockchain. You find this episode in the show notes, of course. Welcome you, John, today.
Thank you. Great to be here again.
John, you bring a wealth of experience few can match, in my opinion. So you served as a chairman of the Icelandic Central Bank's supervisory board. You taught as an adjunct professor at multiple universities and co-founded four software companies. I think your academic credentials include a PhD in economics and a master's degree in engineering, which is a unique combination itself. And you've been visiting scholar at Columbia University. The reason we invited you to this very episode is your particular perspective. Your perspective is valuable because you have a vantage point spanning both sides of the Atlantic. You have operated in New York, Minneapolis, and Palo Alto while heading Seed Forum USA, for example, and you're now leading a European blockchain finance company. So you've witnessed firsthand how policy and regulation in these two regions are different, potentially even diverging, with implications for the future of money and financial infrastructure. So I hope you would agree that my assessment of you operating on both sides of the Atlantic is correct, and you've been exposed to the regulation and running businesses on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah, I lived in New York for 10 years, and I lived in California, and now we have been running a European company for almost, what is it? It's 8 years probably. So, yeah, I think it's interesting to see there's a cultural difference in my mind, the way that the Americans approach things and the way that the Europeans do things. So there are pros and cons for both parties. So yeah, definitely a difference, and we are seeing that in the regulatory landscape and how the policymakers are approaching, especially you know how they want to regulate, for example, stablecoins.
So let's get straight into with our conversation about what might be these consequential regulatory differences, and yeah, different policy approaches. And let's start with your central bank background, as this is super precious. You have central banking experience in Europe. You've chaired the supervisory board of Iceland Central Bank. How has that experience shaped your perspective on how central banks should approach digital currency innovation? Do you see fundamental philosophical differences between how EU and US central bankers view crypto?
Yes, I do so, at least now. So when I was in a central bank, that was after the crash of 2008. And why did we have the crash and why did we have the great financial crisis in 2008 in general? Well, because banks, they went bankrupt, and they that meant that the general public lost access to their deposits, you know, their money. That endangered the whole economy. So, you know, the danger was that regular companies couldn't pay salaries, couldn't buy what they needed to run their businesses and so on. So, and this is a recurring theme in banking and has been for hundreds of years. And don't forget that in 1913, when the Fed in the US was established, it was basically because they were bank runs, and the idea was to basically backstop banks by providing a lender of last resort for the banking system. And then, you know, Bitcoin came and they solved this this issue of double spending. So suddenly we had a solution where we didn't need to rely on a bank to store a digital form of some asset. That's fundamental. How, you know, being in the central bank after the crash and understanding that the technology that was introduced by Satoshi Nakamoto, you could see that, you know, this could potentially change the way we conduct business, and we could improve the system. We could improve the system for society in a way that society wouldn't be that dependent on the banking system. So I saw it as a huge opportunity to improve the system. Now, the incoming government in the US, the current government, seems to embrace this fact. US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says, well, the main thing or the opportunity for people that don't have access to bank accounts is to basically to be able to store their own money for themselves. And this is also echoed by some chair members of the Fed, where they see this is an opportunity. So they acknowledge the opportunity, the technology, which is enabling people to hold their money without the need to trust any central entity. Now, the Europeans seems to, well, they have a different approach. They seem to be more interested in preserving the current system than basically saying, okay, here's a new technology. That's a fact. Let's move forward and try to use it to improve the system. I think this is philosophically the main difference between the two.
Yeah, John, beyond the mere political calculations that you outlined, I would add that central banks on both sides of the Atlantic are approaching digital currencies with different risk philosophies. So the Fed's relaxation only very recently of crypto rules reflects the US prioritizing innovation, market competition, while the ECB's caution stems from legitimate concerns about monetary sovereignty, in my reading. So, for example, when the Fed withdrew its supervisory letters in this month, April 2025, it signaled trust in existing regulatory frameworks to manage crypto risks. Meanwhile, the ECB's warnings about stablecoins reflect its mandate to protect the euro's stability against potential dollarization through digital means. Would you agree with that?
Not entirely. Under MiCA, the current regulation for stablecoins, then if you're a European and you need to go to the grocery store and you need to buy your coffee or whatever, and using stablecoins, then it has to be a European. It has to be a euro stablecoin if you're in the eurozone. So the law is basically making sure that Europeans are using the euro for, you know, everyday transactions. But in the end of the day, we are just entering a new era where it's easy to create new money, or new money instruments. It's easy to use the payment rails. And that means that what was possible before to control both payment rails and money, access to money and so on, that's much more difficult today. We see that, for example, by the, you know, how the BRICS countries are reacting. They can now easily develop their own currencies, their own payment rails, and so on. So I think the approach and the realization of the Europeans should be that the world has changed, and there is going to be much more competition between different types of money, and so the task of the Europeans should be to strengthen the underlying fundamentals for a euro stablecoin so it will be more, shall we say, feasible for people to use. I think that is more important than trying to curb competition or make some players disadvantaged through regulation.
Let's also look at the actual regulatory divergence, if it exists also in your perspective. So I'm seeing a kind of remarkable contrast emerging between the EU's more cautious approach through MiCA and the US's new embrace of crypto under the Trump administration. What do you see as the core drivers behind these two different paths, if you agree that there are two different paths?
Yeah, I think the main difference is that the US sees the private sector and non-bank technical companies as the entities that will drive the adoption of the US dollar denominated stablecoins. That is not the view from the European Central Bank. The European Central Bank has been promoting its own currency, the digital euro, and that is problematic because then you have the regulator, which is setting the rules and monitoring its competitors. I mean, that's not a healthy thing to do, right? So the US is just banking on, shall we say, technical companies to innovate and lead the innovation in business and technology, because I think the realization is that payments and money are going to be embedded in, you know, future technical platforms, you know, whether it's social media platforms, chat, and so on. Their technology companies are simply better positioned to offer compelling and interesting solutions to users. So that is the difference. The US is banking on the private sector to drive this, and the EU is wants the public sector to basically drive this. And I have always said, and I have written about it, that I don't think that's sustainable. I don't think it's a role of a central bank to be trying to compete with the private sector in this market. I don't think the central bank is well positioned to innovate in business and technology. This is this is the approach that is taken by other countries, but so far, the public sector has not been leading in such endeavors.
Yeah, I think this divergence we just agreed upon reflects fundamentally different visions of financial sovereignty and state control in markets that you just alluded to. The EU's approach through MiCA creates, for me, comprehensive guardrails because they view monetary sovereignty as collectively shared and therefore more vulnerable. The US approach under the recent Genius Act, so the upcoming Stablecoin Act, instead leverages crypto innovation to extend American financial influence. I think this is a position you shared, as you just wrote about in Forbes about it. For instance, MiCA's strict limitations on stablecoin issuance contrast sharply with the US framework that encourages banks to issue dollar stablecoins, effectively treating them as tools for financial statecraft, if you will, rather than threats.
Yeah, I mean, look at what the US has done. The US has basically banned central bank digital currency. It's just banned. It's not the role of the bank. It's quite clear. The European Central Bank has been talking about the digital euro that should be issued by the European Central Bank. That has had these consequences, that it's not good for innovation because, for example, investors, they don't want to compete with the central bank and so on. With regards to sovereignty, then that's a very nuanced topic. One important aspect to discuss there is that if you want to make sure that the euro is used, you have to make sure that the euro is the same everywhere, regardless if it's, you know, a bank deposit, if it's a token, if it's on your mobile app. A euro should always be the same. It's in economics, it's called the importance of preserving the singleness of money. Euro should be always the same, regardless of the technical platform. Now, what has happened since MiCA? They have basically fractured the digital euro offerings by saying that there are different rules for banks than non-banks that are licensed to offer the euro in a digital format. And then it is also a difference, different rules if you are a significant issuer or not. And to add on that, then I think it was in February, then there was a decision by the European Central Bank saying that, well, non-bank stablecoin issuers should have access to the settlement system so it can be settled. But, which is a positive thing, no doubt, but they were very explicit and said that licensed non-bank issuers should not have access to any central bank facility for safeguarding the underlying. This is different from what banks are allowed. That means that a euro issued by stablecoin issuers has a different risk profile than if it's issued by a bank. And under MiCA, then you as a stablecoin issuer, a non-bank stablecoin issuer, although licensed, you are required to have up to 12 banks as intermediary. This is insane because the banks are the weak point in this system. And the whole idea with Satoshi Nakamoto was to remove the intermediary. But certainly we have European regulators that insist that if you, in order to basically be allowed to operate in Europe, you have to have them as intermediaries. If you compare to this to, you know, what you were mentioning, the Genius Act and the Staple Act, then there's it. The requirement is that you safeguard the underlying. You can safeguard it in US dollar notes, in cash. You can, if you want, you can safeguard them in US dollar bank accounts. But the emphasis is on treasury, US treasury, high quality liquid assets. And it's especially it's especially said that it should be shorter than 90 days, which was a short duration. This is a sensible approach. I think that, you know, requiring stablecoin issuers to have banks as middlemen is not helpful and doesn't make any sense in my mind. When the European Central Bank is basically saying, we don't want licensed non-bank stablecoin issuers to have access to central bank reserves, then you're basically denying those licensed institutions to have access to the safest form of money, right, of any sovereign. So, and that in by that you're making sure that there will be a different risk profiles between different issuers, which goes against the whole idea that, you know, a euro should always be a euro if it's licensed and legal. It should always be a euro, and it should have a similar, if not the same, risk. So it doesn't make any sense. But unless you read in more detail why they do it, and they do it, and they're quite honest about it. The European Central Bank basically says that, well, we don't want to blur the line between central bank digital currency, the digital euro, and a digital euro issued by licensed non-bank issuers. Wow, that's interesting. So here you have a regulator which is, you know, basically determining the rules for the market that the regulator is going to compete in. And the regulator says, well, we're going to put in place this rule, this regulation, because we want to have a competitive advantage over our competitors. I mean, this is a very frank way of saying this, but this is absolutely what is happening. And what, in my mind, it is so interesting that there is no debate about this. The fundamental question should be, what is really the role of a central bank? Is the role of a central bank to, you know, be competing with the private sector? In the US, no, no way, it's banned. In Europe, yes. And the rules are designed to make it easier. So I think, in my mind, that's very problematic.
John, how about we move from the regulatory divergences we just discussed in general to a specific instance of digital assets, that is stablecoins. So the ECB appears concerned about dollar-denominated stablecoins these days potentially undermining EU financial stability and sovereignty. Meanwhile, the US is embracing stablecoins as a strategic tool for reinforcing dollar dominance. How do you assess the validity of the ECB's concerns? Are the ECB's fears overblown or legitimate?
I think at the moment, at least, it is overblown. And the reason why I say this is that if you look at the technology, why is the technology so popular? Why are stablecoins popular? Why do we have about 240 billion US dollar worth of stablecoins out there? Well, there is a product market fit. And the product market fit is that people in countries where you have unstable currencies and currency that people cannot trust basically to store their wealth, they like to have access to the dollar, but they don't have access to banks. Okay. So a stablecoin is a simple technology in the sense that you can have your wealth or your assets in US dollar denominated digital asset, and you don't need a bank. You can you can take care of it yourself. You are in control. And this is has a big appeal, not in Europe and not in the US. That is not where the biggest demand is now. The biggest demand is outside of Europe, outside of the US, because this is a fundamental problem that US dollar stablecoins are solving. So, and the US is recognizing this fact and see this as an opportunity to basically say, okay, so this is a use case, and we can then basically make it even better by regulating stablecoin, US dollar stablecoins, on a federal level in the US, make them more, you know, make sure that there is consumer protections, AML, there's no question that this is legit and all of that. So it just makes it easier for people around the world, not necessarily in the US or Europe, to hold it. I think that is what is happening. Are European entities using US dollar denominated stablecoins? Well, the rules in Europe are that you have to then be regulated under MiCA. That's what you have to do. So that is the way you protect it. But the best protection, in my mind, for a euro or digital euro, whether it's issued by a non-bank or bank or whomever, is basically to make sure that the euro as a token that is, you know, offered as a licensed token is superior. It is safe, secure, regulated, and it is promoted and offered by technology companies that know what they're doing. They embed it into all kinds of solutions, make it easier for you to use it and so on. That's the best protection to make sure that you have the adoption that you need and protect the sovereignty of the euro. You have to make sure that you or the euro can compete on the global stage. And the way to do it is not to basically lock yourself in and say, well, we are now going to fragment the euro. We're going to make special rules for banks, and we're going to make other rules for central banks. And we're going to make, you know, the third set of rules for non-bank but licensed stablecoin issuers. You should try to, you know, make sure that you have the best alternative. That is what the US is doing. They are trying to come up with a regulation, I think, which is, you know, better than the regulation that we have in Europe. So I think that, you know, the way to preserve the euro and make sure that it is used, you just have to be better than the others. The world has changed. The technology is changing the way we have to think about it. It's not about, there is no monopoly now about issuing money I'm not talking about the euro. You can have all kinds of euro. There's no monopoly in issuing other types of money, and it is much easier now than before to create payment rates. So it's about competition. The Europeans, they would just have to be competitive.
So an aspect that we didn't touch upon so far are reserves and bank charters. The US is moving toward requiring stablecoin issuers to have bank charters or licenses with strict one-to-one reserve requirements. Meanwhile, the EU's MiCA creates a different framework. How do these two approaches compare in terms of financial stability and consumer protection? So I think now we're really comparing Genius and MiCA.
Yeah. So we see that the requirement is one-to-one, 100% backed stablecoins. MiCA requires 2% extra, that is 102% backing. And for a significant issuer, it has to be 3%, okay? And then it's also about, you know, how you're going to safeguard the underlying, with whom and in what assets and so on. So there is a difference there. Obviously, if you're an issuer and you have to hold more than 100%, then that's going to cost you. So it's about competitive advantage if you can get away with a lower collateral. But on the other hand, it's also about the security, because we know that the underlying assets, they can move even if they are short term. So that is a trade-off that you have. We don't know if this is going to be the final result of Genius or the Stable Act in the US. There is a difference there. And there is also a very remarkable and interesting difference in the sense that there seems to be an emphasis on that the underlying safeguarded assets will be safeguarded as treasuries, basically governmental debt. So it seems to be a strategic decision by the US to increase the demand for treasury, increase the demand for treasuries, increase the demand to basically fund the US government. I think that's very, very interesting. That is different from Europe, because Europe, under both the e-money directive and MiCA, then you can hold the underlying assets in a diverse collection of, you know, high quality liquid assets, whether it's governments or high quality corporate bonds or bills.
I think both approaches, that is Genius and MiCA, offer viable models, but the US framework could prove a bit more adaptable to market evolution. So the one-to-one reserve requirement in both frameworks does provide essential stability. That's a must, as customer protection is at the forefront. But the US approach, integrating stablecoins into banking regulation, leverages existing oversight mechanisms. MiCA creates a separate regulatory category, potentially creating artificial distinctions as technologies converge. So, for example, a stablecoin issuer under US banking charter would be subject to capital requirements, stress testing, and resolution planning, all proven tools for managing financial risks rather than creating entirely new frameworks. Do you agree with this one distinction in the US and EU approaches?
It's a little bit more nuanced, because if you're a bank and if you issue a stablecoin, then it will affect, for example, it depends how you do it. But if you offer a stablecoin, which is a bearer instrument, then it affects your liquidity coverage ratio in a different way. So it's a technical thing. But under MiCA, there are also, and the technical standards issued by the European Banking Authority, then there are some provisions to think about. You know, there is a, you know, you have to do some, you have to do other requirements for banks. But I think what is interesting, just from a, you know, strategic point of view, is that stablecoins are essentially, I mean, they are all backed 100%. And what is that? It is a narrow bank. Okay, it is it's a different system. It's a different banking system. The banking system that we have in Europe and in the US is a fractional reserve banking system. It's only, you know, the assets are backed not fully but partly. So I think, you know, when you are offering stable coins which are based on the narrow bank banking system or full reserve banking system, I think it's an interesting question. You know, how easy it is for banks to participate in this market. I don't think it's very easy, and I think it's an interesting question that we have to dwell better into at a later stage. If really banks that are operating under the fractional reserve system, if they are and should be allowed to issue stable coins. My answer to that is I haven't developed it fully, but I think that's a very interesting question. Should fractional reserve banks be allowed to be issuers where the system is a full reserve banking system? It's like, you know, if you're a non-bank licensed e-money institution, then you are basically a narrow bank in the sense that it's fully backed. And therefore, you are not allowed to go into fractional reserve banking because these are different systems. But it goes just one way. So fractional reserve banks, they can participate in the narrow bank system in a way, but not the other way around. I think it should be reversed, actually.
Yeah, so with that, we touched upon reserves and bank charters or the regulatory requirements on both sides of the Atlantic. I suggest we now deep dive into Europe, into central bank tensions in Europe. A dispute has erupted between the European Central Bank and the European Commission over the adequacy of the EU's crypto regulation known as MiCA in the face of potential pro-crypto policies from a Trump-led US administration. So there seems to be a tension between the ECB and European Commission regarding the regulation of digital assets. What do you make of this internal struggle within EU institutions? Is this about finding the right role of a central bank in regulating digital assets? Does it reflect deeper disagreements about monetary sovereignty versus innovation in Europe?
What I think it says is that we're just early in this market and we didn't get the regulation perfect in MiCA. So there is a room for improvement. I think that's what it says. So there is a disagreement between different institutions in Europe. And I think that's a good thing. If you have a constructive disagreement, then you're approaching something. You are talking about some issues that one party wants to improve. So I think it's a positive thing. I wouldn't say that this is a problem. I think this is really a good thing. If you look at, you know, when I was in the US and I lived there, it was always, you know, you watched debates on TV and so on. And there was always this argument, you know, back and forth. And for someone that comes from a country where this is a common thing, it was nothing new. But maybe for someone that is, or people that are not, shall we say, exposed to disagreement or harsh disagreement on a regular basis, it sounds like a bad thing. But actually, I think it's a good sign that policymakers and different European institutions are discussing this and having a disagreement. It means that, you know, there's a room for improvement. And I certainly think there is. So hopefully there's something positive coming out of this.
Yes, I agree. The tension between ECB and Commission reveals just the fundamental challenge of regulating financial innovation in complex governance structures. So to me also, this institutional disagreement is a feature, not a bug, of the EU's governance model, where monetary policy on the one hand and market regulation on the other hand are just deliberately separated. So the ECB's focus on financial stability naturally clashes with the Commission's broader economic mandate. For instance, when the commission wrote that the ECB's concerns seem to be overstated, quote unquote, it wasn't merely a technical disagreement, but a fundamental question of who should determine Europe's crypto stance or crypto policy stance, monetary authorities or democratic institutions. So I agree, it's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, and I think this is really interesting what you're saying, because what is happening is fundamental, you know? You said, okay, so crypto is going to affect monetary policy. Should the monetary policy authorities regulate crypto? Well, I think that can be problematic. And the reason I say that is that, you see, monetary policy is based on fractional reserve banking. What is the central bank doing, the European Central Bank doing when he's changing interest rate? He's trying to affect the price of money. So the fractional reserve banks, they issue more or less new loans. And new loans are the way that new money is created in the economy. But that is only in the fractional reserve system. So if we are moving into a system where they will be less dominant, that we will be less dependent on them, then we have to respond to that fact. But the tendency of the incumbents that have been used to do things, you know, over decades in a certain way, and this is all based on the premise that we are indirectly influencing the fractional reserve system, which is weakening by this, then I don't think that is the institution that should decide this. Of course, they have an input in all of that. But in the end of the day, it should be a democratic process. Just like in the US, it's a democratic process that said, you can disagree or not, but it was a democratic process that said, we're going to ban central bank digital currency. Okay? And we are going to embrace this new technology to try to make the system better. And we're going to try to use it to reinforce the dollar dominance or the role of the US dollar around the globe. That was what the new government said, and that was a democratic process. I think Europe needs more democratic process, and this needs to be discussed more openly outside the institution as well.
So, John, so far we've talked from an economics point of view, a policy point of view. But as you know, Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll is predominantly an institutional crypto podcast with many business leaders, decision makers among its followers and listeners. So we do need to touch upon practical business impact too, which is certainly possible with you as you are the co-founder of Monerium. So in this role, how are these regulatory divergences affecting your business? Are you finding yourself having to make difficult choices between markets, adapting to different policies, or is this just the nature or the cost of doing business globally that you are subject to different regulations?
At the moment, you have different regulation in different jurisdictions. We have been focused on Europe. Europe was leading in the regulatory space. And hopefully there will be revision of the rules there. What I think is also important to have in mind is that the regulatory framework is developing, like we see in the US. And because there is a competition between the US and Europe, you know, hopefully Europe will see, okay, so the US is doing this, maybe we should do that. And then the US is going to respond, and then Asia and so on. So I think we're in a phase now where the regulation is being designed on the fly in a way. And at some point, we will hopefully come to a framework that is practical, efficient for businesses, and to make sure that there is financial stability and it supports growth in different countries and so on. When we have that, then it would be fantastic to have, you know, whether it's organically or through some institutions, a better coordinated standard how this works in different jurisdictions. Because the change that Satoshi Nakamoto came with was basically saying, well, you don't need the intermediary, number one, but you can also use money, this type of money, all around the globe. And it should be as easy as sending an email, right? And that is what we're aiming for. Then we have to have better, shall we say, standards, or it has to be more standard around the globe how these rules are. We will converge into such a standard organically or through some formal process. But I think what the US is showing us now is that there is still room for improvement, and we shouldn't move too quickly to standardize something which is not so good.
Yeah, it's like in co-evolution, isn't it? The co-evolution of digital assets businesses and in co-evolution with policy and regulation globally. And advice I usually give in my role as IT architect at SAP is that companies must build regulatory optionality into their core business architecture rather than treating compliance as an afterthought after promoting a product or service. So what I mean is that these different policy approaches force blockchain businesses to design products with modular compliance layers that can adapt to different jurisdictions, be it the US, the EU, or elsewhere. For example, a stablecoin business might develop a core settlement layer with different reserve structures, transparency reporting, and governance models deployable based on jurisdiction. And this requires investing in regulatory technology that can dynamically adjust to different regulatory requirements, essentially building multiple businesses under one brand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Okay, but at least at Monerium, that's not the case because you have a sole European focus, right?
Yeah, well, we are very heavily focused on Europe, but what is happening in the US is very encouraging to us. We believe that there will be a new legislation by August or September. That is the official statement. We believe that is achievable. And if it goes the way it seems to be going, then it would be really tempting to basically be more involved and regulate it even in the US. You see, this is competition. And this is what Europeans should always think about. You cannot protect yourself with regulation when you are in this market. This is a global market. Payments are now global, and money is going to move freely around the globe. So we have to just make sure that whatever we do, the alternatives that we have, the euro, is superior. And hopefully, I'm hoping that the Europeans will change or revise the rules. But as it stands now, I think the US might become, later in the year, a very interesting market to operate in. I mean, there's 99.8% of the stablecoins, they are US dollar denominated. There is so little in the euro. So there is a need to promote this, to back it, to make sure that this is a better alternative.
So another policy difference in the US and Europe is the coexistence of CBDC versus private stablecoins. We touched upon it, just didn't find the time to deep dive into it so far.
I think I did. I was... sorry.
No worries. We touched upon it. I just want to deep dive because it's a super important difference. So the ECB seems to be positioning its digital euro project as a counterbalance to private stablecoins, and at least in my reading. Do you think CBDCs and private stablecoins can coexist, or are they fundamentally competing visions? I ask because that's exactly what the US leans to, not promoting a digital dollar and entirely focusing on private stablecoins.
Yeah, so I think that retail CBDC and stablecoins issued by non-banks or banks, they cannot coexist. Because there is always this temptation from the regulator to design some rules and regulation that are favorable to the ECB. It's not normal that one of the market player is overseeing the others and designing the rules. It is not normal. So you have to make up your mind. Either you trust the private sector in this market, like we have done for 100 years. You know, digital versions of money, they have so far, for the general public, they have so far been provided by the private sector. Now, the central banks, they have provided coins and notes, but they are not competing with the private sector there because they have a monopoly for that. But now the ECB wants to change that and enter the market and compete. It doesn't work in my mind. It shouldn't be that way. There are many reasons why to oversee and regulate your competitors is one, and also it is really discouraging for investors that want to invest in the private sector to you know be competing with the public sector. This is a system that we should not follow. But the central bank and a CBDC has a role as a wholesale CBDC. Wholesale CBDC can be the backing of with reserves. That is the role of central banks and a very natural extension of what the central bank is doing. It should be backing the issuers if they prefer so. That was a possibility until February this year to have a backing with at least one central bank in the Eurozone. It's no longer available. So wholesale CBDC, yes, we should encourage that. And it is also important to make sure that it's easy to safeguard the underlying in different jurisdictions. And then there, the central bank has a big role to interact with other central banks around the world to make sure that the flow between the jurisdiction is seamless and efficient. But to compete in the retail market, that is not the role of a central bank. No. And I don't say this as, I am a participant in this market as a private sector issuer. But in general, it is really hard for the public and private to be competing, and let alone if the public entity is also regulating and overseeing the competitors. It doesn't make any sense.
Yes, I agree. In my reading, when I attend or listen to central bankers in Europe, is that the ECB's digital euro stance is intimately connected to its stable coins concerns that we learned about this month. So the ECB views private stable coins as potential competitors to its monetary sovereignty, making the digital euro a strategic counter-offering. The Fed's more measured CBDC approach reflects greater confidence in dollar dominance through market mechanisms. So technically, the ECB's digital euro architecture focuses heavily on programmable money features that could compete with stablecoins in wholesale settings, at least, while emphasizing privacy and offline capabilities for retail adoption, directly addressing stablecoins' current advantages. So in the EU, we have an ECB reaction that tries to fight stablecoins and that stem from stablecoin concerns by a central bank. While in the US, we have trust in stablecoins contributing to US dollar dominance globally.
Yeah, and I think the European Central Bank has to answer two questions. First, what is the problem that the European Central Bank is really solving? I haven't seen a convincing answer to that. And second, what do stablecoin issuers, whether they're banks or non-banks, how are they a threat to the central bank? Stablecoin issuers are regulated in such a way that it's backed by assets, high quality liquid assets, or in Europe, you're required to be in a bank as well. There is no money creation in this process, okay? So it is not affecting the money supply. It is a tool to basically make it easier to transact with money. It's a different form of money. It is not the role of a central bank, and I don't understand why they should be afraid of a digital euro issued by non-bank or bank issuer. I don't see the danger there. Sorry.
Yeah, it will certainly be super interesting the two stances in the US and EU play out. Can stablecoins and CBDCs coexist? Does it need both forms of money? Are they competing each other? This question has been raised early, ever been discussed throughout the evolution of digital assets. We won't find the answer today, but we will certainly have an eye on that. A last dimension I want to touch upon before we conclude is bank integration. I think the integration in banks convergence of traditional finance and at least CeFi, central finance, is an important difference in both economies. In the US, we're seeing crypto pushing deeper into the banking system with firms like Circle and BitGo pursuing bank charters. Do you view this integration of crypto with traditional banking as positive, or does it risk importing the volatility of crypto into the traditional financial system?
Well, the reason that if you're a non-bank issuer and you don't have access to the central bank, then the way to solve that is to become a bank. Okay? That is not optimal. It's unnecessary. The easier way is to make sure that you have the right access to the central bank as a licensed institution. You don't need to do it. But it depends on the regulation what you have to do. You know? So it's important what the regulators do. The opportunity is to rethink the fundamentals and support non-bank licensed institutions in a different way than is done today in Europe, but in a similar way as we're seeing that the intention is in the US. So, is Circle going to become a bank? I think that will depend on the final version of the regulation in the US. Why would they need to do it? If there is no access to the Fed in the US, then maybe they will need that in order to access the central bank. But the better way is just to say, well, if you're a licensed institution and you need, for example, repo assets, you have the high quality liquid assets, you got the underlying assets of the customer. And in case of demand or redemption of stablecoins, then you might need a liquidity provider against solid collateral, like high quality liquid assets. And this is a service that central banks provide. One of the basics of the working of central banks. Why don't they provide this service to banks and non-banks alike? Then you have solved the liquidity issue. And then those non-bank institutions, they don't need to become banks in order to access this service. Why would they need that? There is no additional additional benefit in doing so. I don't think so, unless you want to integrate into some other business areas. But for the issuance of stablecoins, you don't need that.
I think you're very much coming from a business perspective, from a business administration perspective, but viewed from a policymaker's perspective, bringing crypto firms under banking regulation creates transparency and accountability. So it might be a positive. It reduces systemic risk compared to a parallel financial system. So, for example, when Circle, issuing USDC, operates under banking oversight, its reserves and risk management become subject to established prudential standards, which from a policymaker's perspective is a positive, isn't it? And the alternative, allowing crypto to develop entirely outside banking, might create greater risks through regulatory arbitrage, hidden interconnections, as we saw with FTX's collapse affecting multiple financial institutions.
We can take very specific examples since you mentioned Circle. In 2023, then Silicon Valley Bank, which is a fractional reserve bank, collapsed. Well, there was a bank run on the bank. One of the deposit holder was Circle. They had a large proportion billions of dollars in deposits at Silicon Valley Bank. Okay, and that caused problem for those that held USDC, US denominated stablecoin, because they relied on a bank that went, you know, there was a bank run, another bank run, which has been happening over the last hundreds of years, and it's continuing. So how do you solve that? Well, if Circle, a licensed company complying with all the rules, would be able to hold the underlying assets in high quality liquid asset, let's say in Treasury, US Treasury, less than 90 days, with less than 19 days in duration, then if the central bank would provide Circle with his service of saying, well, you can repo your Treasury into the Fed, and we provide liquidity to meet redemption, okay? Then it would be a much safer system than if you are relying on banks like Circle did when they deposited a large proportion of their safeguarded assets in Silicon Valley Bank. So, and understandably, then Circle says, well, we would like to become a bank if this is needed. But this is not needed if the central bank offer a similar service, providing liquidity against high quality liquid assets, high quality collateral on a short-term basis, like they do for banks, then the problem is solved. And you wouldn't have any bank run. You wouldn't have any depegging. You know, this is the way forward in my mind. And we don't need, and I think it's an opportunity for society in general, globally. We will become less dependent on the banking system. Banks will have a different role, but they will not be, if they go under, or if they take some risk, which goes sour, and they go bankrupt, then it shouldn't threaten the society. That's the main thing. That is basically the message from Satoshi Nakamoto. He wanted to create a system where you remove the intermediaries. So let's finish the job. Remove the intermediaries and don't let the regulators, neither in Europe nor or the US or anywhere in the world, try to convince us that we need the intermediaries. We do not. We should get rid of the intermediaries, and we should get the system much safer in that way. That is the main thing.
John, your call for getting rid of the intermediaries brings us to the end of today's conversation. What's clear from our 1 hour discussion is that we're witnessing far more than just technical regulatory differences. We're seeing different visions for the future of money, state power, and financial innovation play out between the US and EU. The implications extend far beyond the crypto industry itself, but could impact global capital flows, monetary sovereignty, and the international role of major currencies even. This transatlantic divide highlights how digital currencies have moved from the fringes to become central to geopolitical and economic considerations. If you had told me that 5 years ago, I would not have believed you. So whether you believe the ECB's concerns about financial stability are justified or see the US approach as the path to continued innovation, one thing to me at least is certain: the decisions being made now shape our financial system potentially for the decades to come. So it's an interesting inflection point in the history of money, actually. So
it is very interesting. And this disagreement, shall we say, between the US and Europe is a good thing. It is basically moving the discussion forward. And what comes out of a constructive disagreement is very often a good solution. And I think that is going to happen here.
So to our listeners, to the professionals in banking, fintech, and digital assets, understanding these divergent approaches isn't just academically interesting. It's becoming essential to navigate the increasingly complex global regulatory landscape. I think John, as executive director of Monerium, would sign that statement. We'd like to thank you, John, for sharing your extraordinary insights with us today, your unique perspective spanning central banking, entrepreneurship, and blockchain. has given us a more nuanced understanding that few others could provide. To our listeners, remember to subscribe to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock'n'Roll wherever you get your podcasts, and join us next week when we'll be exploring another critical development in the evolution of digital finance. Until then, this is Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock'n'Roll, bringing Europe's perspective on digital currencies to the world. Thanks for listening, and thank you, John.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.